The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
To get a complimentary copy of Dave's book and a complimentary consultation, call 877-GAINS-4U or MortashFinancial.com.
If we look to the answer as to why for so many years we achieved so much, prospered as no other people on earth, it was because here in this land, we unleashed the energy and individual genius of man to a greater extent than has ever been done before. Those who say that we're in a time when there are no heroes, they just don't know where to look. The sloping hills of Arlington National Cemetery, with its row upon row of simple white markers bearing crosses or stars of David, they add up to only a tiny fraction of the price that has been paid for our freedom. As for the enemies of freedom, those who are potential adversaries, they will be reminded that peace is the highest aspiration of the American people. We will negotiate for it, sacrifice for it. We will not surrender for it now or ever. We are Americans.
Welcome to Always Right Radio with Bob Frantz on AM 1420, The Answer.
Welcome indeed. It is 7 minutes after the hour of 9 o'clock, and we are ready to rock and or roll as the situation may require. On this Tuesday, the 12th morning of the third month in the year of our Lord, 2024. Got a big show lined up for you. Pretty crowded show, in fact, coming up in about a half an hour, we're going to talk to a writer and reporter from The Blaze named Delano Squires. And Delano and I are going to talk about DEI and a couple of other really important things. He says DEI needs to go the way of BLM. And by the way, he's a black man. He's a black man, and he said BLM needed to die and DEI needs to die. And with good reason, because it is dividing and tearing this country apart and discriminating against American citizens. We're going to talk to him about that report at 9:35. At 10:10, we're going to talk to Peter Kersenow, as we do each and every Tuesday. Happy Kersenow Day to you. And at 11:10, we are going to talk with Mihek Cook. So we've got a full show for you today, but we also have time for you, and we'll get you in before, between, and after those interviews at 216-901-0945. And 888-281-1110. I have a lot of news to get to in the monologue this morning, so we are going to start right now with our Pledge of Allegiance. Patriots, if you're a true believer in this glorious republic and the flag that represents her, then go ahead and stand right now and face the flag that you have. If you're driving and you've got a flag on your dash, your rearview mirror, you're awesome. What a patriot you are. You don't have to stand because you're driving, but you can put your hand on your heart and join us. If you are a believer in Joe Biden's attempted destruction of the United States of America, along with his globalist allies, then don't fake your support for this country. The hell with your virtue signaling. We'd rather have you take a knee so we can identify you as the Marxist that you are. The rest of us, however, stand and say,
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right. Robert Hur, the special counsel who investigated Joe Biden and his extraordinary use of his office as a senator and then as a vice president to obtain and to retain classified documents in violation of the law. Let's remember, they're coming after Donald Trump for documents that were found at Mar-a-Lago, despite the fact that he, as president, had the authority to declassify those. Joe Biden, at the time we're talking about, was not president, could not declassify anything, took them anyway. Moreover, stored them carelessly, haphazardly, left them out in the open, left them in the garage next to the Corvette, left them in full sight and with access to a member of his family who was an addicted crackhead who was trading on his name with foreign governments, making it legitimate to wonder if he could have thought about trading some classified documents with foreign governments. It's all possible. We know that Joe Biden gave some of those foreign documents to his ghostwriter to write his autobiography, his memoirs. Robert Hur investigated all of that, found it all to be true, said it was willful, then said, I'm not going to recommend prosecuting him for it. Wait, what? Why? Well, it's likely that despite this willful illegal conduct, it's likely that a jury is going to look at him and see a weak, frail, well-intentioned old man with a bad memory. And because of that, they're going to feel sympathy for him and they're not going to convict him. So we're not going to waste the time trying. Joe Biden flipped his you-know-what over that. Joe Biden, when that report came out, called a hasty press conference for that evening and proceeded to tell all kinds of lies about what was in the report and proceeded then to yell at the press for daring to question anything about his mental fitness, and he condemned Robert Hur for the report itself.
In addition, I know there's some attention paid to some language in the report about my recollection of events. There's even reference that I don't remember when my son died. How in the hell dare he raise that? Frankly, when I was asked the question, I thought to myself, it wasn't any of their damn business. Let me tell you something. Some of you have commented, I wear since the day he died, every single day, the rosary he got from Our Lady of
I don't know. From the day he died. Not only does he not remember the day he died, according to Robert Hur, he didn't remember the year he died. And he wasn't off by one. He didn't remember, according to Robert Hur, within a span of several years when his son died. That's how bad his memory really is. Jim Jordan and James Comer, chairs of the respective judiciary and oversight committees, have subpoenaed Robert Hur for the transcripts of the interviews and any recordings that were used and made in his interviews with Joe Biden as part of that investigation. Hur has not come forth with those transcripts yet, but he has agreed to testify. That is in less than an hour. At about 10 o'clock, Robert Hur, the special counsel who made that report, will be testifying before the Judiciary Committee. We now have at least part of his opening statement has been released to the media. So you know what he's going to say in his opening comments before the Q&A begins. And I have it here, and I want to share some of this with you. In his report, or in his testimony, rather, he's going to say that his report does reflect his best efforts to explain why he declined to recommend charging Biden for his willful mishandling of classified charges, but he is going to defend his description of Biden's cognitive abilities, or lack thereof. And I'll quote this some of this now for you. My assessment in the report about the relevance of the president's memory was necessary and accurate and fair. Most importantly, what I wrote is what I believe the evidence shows and what I expect jurors would perceive and believe. I did not sanitize my explanation, nor did I disparage the president unfairly. I explained to the attorney general my decision and the reason for it. That's what I was required to do. Now, I'll pause the quote there and say, so he's saying I didn't disparage the president, which is what the left-wing media and Biden himself claimed that he did, that this was an unfair attack and an unfounded attack on his mental acuity and his memory and so on and so forth. He said, I analyzed the evidence as prosecutors routinely do by assessing the strengths. Not sorry, I shouldn't say he said. He wrote this and we'll say this in an hour. Less than an hour. By assessing the strengths and weaknesses of the evidence, including by anticipating the ways in which the president's defense lawyers might poke holes in the government's case, if there were a trial, and seek to persuade jurors that the government could not prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. He will also say, quote, there has been a lot of attention paid to language in the report about the president's memory, so let me say a few words about that. My task was to determine whether the president retained or disclosed national defense information willfully, meaning knowingly, and with the intent to do something the law forbids. I could not make that determination without assessing the president's state of mind. And that's why he talked at length about the president's state of mind in the report. Now, one more note about that, especially going back to the audio clip that I just played for you of Joe Biden insisting he knows everything about his son's death. And how dare Robert Hur even mention that or even bring that up? And he talked about how I responded to the question that I know to the day when my son died because I wear this rosary that I got from Our Lady of I don't know. Robert Hur, according to multiple sources who are familiar with the investigation, didn't ask him about his son's death. Joe Biden brought it up. So his, how dare he talk about that? He didn't. Biden brought it up. But since he brought it up, Robert Hur felt it was in his, it was his responsibility to point out that he didn't know when it happened, that he didn't know when his son died and didn't know within a period of years. So it's part of the explanation as to why he said his memory is so bad that he doesn't think that a jury would convict him because they would feel bad for him because he doesn't even remember important things in his life like when his son died. All of this is going to come out in his opening statement today and then obviously in the question and answer period. But Biden brought up Bo's death in the interview, not the special counsel. It is important to note. So we're going to follow that closely as we can. We're going to try to monitor it. Who knows? I may even carry a minute or two of it, but I do have Kirsten out at the same time coming up at that time. But we're going to do our very best. But Robert Hur's testimony today is going to be very, very important. The Democrats are going to try to attack him for saying that Joe Biden is in cognitive decline because he's 8 months away from a reelection. And they cannot be viewed that way. That's why they pumped him so full of drugs, whatever they could find, to make him have energy and vigor on Thursday during the State of the Union. Of course, probably a few too many because he ended up being so energized, he was yelling at the people, yelling at the country. It was the most divisive, most aggressive, most unbelievably attacking and partisan State of the Union address ever given. And he's the great uniter, we were told. But they pumped him up so full of drugs on that night that he sounded like a madman. Well, yesterday in New Hampshire, I mentioned that he was putting an audience to sleep in New Hampshire, which he did. Yesterday, without the drugs, without the State of the Union cocktail, whatever it is they gave him, the real Joe Biden came back out.
Tremendous amount of things you can cut. Maybe precise. Tremendous amount of things you can do, not cut. He said, "I will." And but the bottom line is, he's still at it.
Did you hear that? When the drugs wear off, reality sets in again, and that's who he is, and that's what Robert Hur is going to talk about today. The Robert Hur testimony is going to be huge today, but it is not going to be enough. Jim Jordan and James Comer are right to subpoena the entire transcript and the recordings, and those recordings must be made public for two reasons. One, he was the vice president of the United States who willfully took and kept classified documents and had been doing so for years, even going back to his time in the Senate. So the American people deserve to know exactly what was said during that investigation and those interviews, especially if the argument from the special counsel as to why he's not facing charges is that he's not mentally capable of standing up to those charges. Then it is it's fair for us to expect to be able to hear those things, those recordings. That's number one. But the second reason is there's an election in 8 months. And when that election happens, we deserve to know if this guy is, honestly, so far outside of normal parameters of cognitive ability for an 81-year-old that he cannot be entrusted with nuclear codes, top secret information, classified intelligence briefings, making decisions that are going to affect this country. It absolutely is in the public's best interest, in the nation's best interest, that we get those documents, those transcripts, and yes, those recordings of the interviews. So hopefully that is something that is one of the questioners, maybe even the chair, Jim Jordan, or someone today can get out of Robert Hur, which is a pledge to turn those things over to Congress, which they should do. Now, last part about that. Biden yesterday, after putting that audience to sleep in New Hampshire by not knowing what in the living hell he was talking about.
Tremendous amount of things you can cut. Let me be precise. Tremendous amount of things you can do, not cut. He said, but the bottom line is, he's still at it.
That's so embarrassing. It really is. After he put that audience to sleep, and by the way, you can compare and contrast that to the Trump rally that was held in Georgia. It's funny, but it's not funny. It's just embarrassing for him. But after he put that audience to sleep and into a coma, he left. And he was on his way out to Air Force One, where, of course, it's loud as heck. So be prepared. Turn your radio down real quick because you're about to get hit with really loud audio here. But then turn it back up so you can hear him talk. A reporter is going to ask him when he's going to take executive action on the border. And I want you to hear what Joe Biden says.
President, when is an border executive action coming? An executive action on the border.
Count on the border action happened by itself. The passing it.
Mr. Biden, when is a border executive action coming? The reply, I'm counting on the border action happening by itself. By it passing. So in other words, he's going to make Congress pass the ridiculous non-border security package that includes all of that aid to Ukraine and allows minimum of 1.825 million illegal aliens to come into this country every single year. Let me say that again. Minimum of 1.825 million every single year. Talking about 5,000 a week. That's what he said. He's saying he doesn't have to take a border, any executive action on the border, and can't take any executive action on the border, but it's going to be handled for him by Congress. Or at least that's what he's hoping for. But here's the problem. He doesn't need a congressional action. In fact, it was executive action, which the reporter asked him about, that was taken on day one, January 21st, 2021, the day after the inauguration. It was that very day that he signed not one, not two, not three, not 10, not 20, not 50, not 75, but 94 separate orders, executive orders, without Congress, without any spending bills, just executive orders that rolled back Trump era border security policies and opened the border. He literally did that by himself. And now he's standing there telling a reporter, I can't do that. It's going to have to happen by itself, meaning Congress is going to have to do something here. And even if Congress did want to pass that, it still wouldn't secure the border. So he's going to stand there and let this continue, even though as recently as 15 years ago, his former boss, Barack Obama, in 2009, warned us all that...
I think the American people, they appreciate and believe in immigration, but they can't have a situation where you just have 500,000 people pouring over the border without any kind of mechanism to control it.
You can't have 500,000 people pouring over the border, he said, without some kind of mechanism to control it. He said 500,000. How about 9.5 million? Because that's what has poured over the border, using Barack Obama's own verb. That's how many have poured over the border in the 3 years plus now of the Biden administration. So this is so extraordinarily dangerous, and all of this needs to be brought out. And Robert Hur today had better tell the truth, and the Democrats better let him speak the truth about what he found through hours and hours and hours of interviews with Joseph R. Biden about his classified documents that were kept in 10 different locations, including at the University of Pennsylvania in a building owned by the Chinese, including boxes of classified documents in his garage next to his Corvette, a Corvette that was easily accessible by Hunter Biden, whom we have seen driving it. That means Hunter Biden, a known and admitted crack addict and a known and admitted business associate of foreign countries that are adversarial to the United States, had access to documents that those countries might have been interested in. By the way, boxes that were not like, you know, safely protected. They were boxes that Robert Hurst report described as being so worn out they had to transfer the contents into new boxes because the bottoms were tearing through of the old ones. That's how haphazardly Joe Biden kept those materials. This man is literally, not figuratively, not metaphorically, literally incapable of running an ice cream stand. First of all, he'd eat all the profits, but literally not capable of running something like a business. If he had to balance ledgers, if he had to order supplies, he couldn't do it. And he's running the most powerful economy and the most powerful military, the most powerful country in the history of man. It needs to be exposed. Part of that expose will be with Robert Hur today. Again, his testimony starts at about 10 o'clock this morning. So we've got a lot to work our way through today. I told you it was a ton of stuff in the monologue. We just barely scratched the surface. Stay here.
Thank you for finally noticing.
Waking up America from its woke slumber. Always Right Radio with Bob France on The Answer.
All right, it is 9:36. Thanks so much for being with us on this very important edition of Always Right Radio. Big day today. Kirsten and I was coming up at 10:10. We're going to kind of react a little bit in real time to Robert Hur's testimony that'll be given right at around that time. So we're looking forward to that. Told you last week about the great news at the University of Florida. They have decided to comply with Governor Ron DeSantis and the Florida State Board of Education's order, essentially, that funding, state and federal funding, not be used to promote any DEI initiatives. So they fired the entire DEI staff and department at the University of Florida. Same time, I got a new one here. DEI must die, said Nebraska State Senator Dave Merman. He's got a bill out that would ban university diversity pledges as well. Lead sponsor of Legislative Bill 1330, prohibiting public colleges and universities from requiring employees to participate in DIE programs or sign contracts requiring support for it. It would also ban spending tax dollars on DEI programs. So these are good steps in the right direction, but there is a long, long way to go. Read a great article on The Blaze yesterday by Delano Squires. Like Black Lives Matter, DEI must die. BLM must die, and it kind of has. Well, to an extent anyway. DEI must do the same, says Delano Squires. So I want to welcome him to our program now. Delano is a research fellow at the in the Richard and Helen DeVos Center for Life, Religion, and Family at the Heritage Foundation, in addition to being a contributor to Blaze Media. Delano, good to have you on our program. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for making the time. You had some school stuff today with the kids, huh?
I did. Yeah, we just got finished. We had a we homeschool, but we meet once a week as a homeschool community, and we had a family presentation. So I just got finished with that. But glad to be here.
Well, that is awesome. First of all, thank you for, like I said, hustling to get in here so we can have this chat. But I didn't know about the homeschool thing, and that's gonna demand a follow up. Tell me why you and you know, I think millions of other families are kind of finding out that this is the right thing to do for them. Why was that the right thing for you and your family?
Well, because I think first of all, it stems from our view of education, which we see as equal parts, you know, scholarship and discipleship. So it's academic mastery and moral formation. And at a certain point, I think every parent has to ask themselves whether the way in which their children are being formed morally aligns with their values. And what I saw from many schools, especially public schools, is that they are so out of step with the values of myself and my wife that we decided over a period of time that the best choice for us was to educate our children at home.
And I'm so happy to hear that. I mean, great for you. We continue on this program. We're covering education from all different angles, between CRT and social-emotional learning and DIE and all of the other things, overt sexualization of kids at a very young age for the purposes of getting them into an agenda. All of these things are just so dangerous, and more people are looking for alternatives to government-run mm-hmm. schools. So homeschooling seems to be certainly a popular part of that. Can you tell me exactly how and when we got to this point where they stopped being concerned with test scores, mathematics abilities, ability to read and write at a high proficient level, to understanding actual history, not made-up history, to the point where they are trying to do what you just said, and that is to replace family morals and integrity and values with their own?
Well, it's hard to pinpoint, but I can say, you know, I finished high school in the year 2000, and I don't ever remember hearing my teachers talk about their political views. Mm-hmm. They never talked about their personal lives, and I think that's because at that point the school was seen as primarily catering to the needs of students. But today the schoolhouse is about affirming the identities of adults, and many of those adults want to inject mm-hmm. you know, sort of partisan politics into the classroom. They want to inject a sexual orientation and gender identity. And I think one of the reasons why is because so many of our schools, particularly our public schools, have failed, to your point, to teach the basics, reading, writing, and arithmetic. And in general, this, I think, this is human nature. When you fail to do the things you're responsible for, oftentimes your instinct is to reach the things that you're not responsible for that you think you'd be more successful at doing. And I think that's one reason why, you know, you start to see these ideas creep up in schools. I think the other one is because educators, and particularly on the left, understand something that many parents and conservatives do not, which is they see the classroom as the training ground and boot camp for future voters. And that's why they're intent on promoting their particular types of political ideology in the classroom, because they understand that they're shaping voters. There was a time when we saw school as, you know, shaping the future workforce, but I think point now where schools in many districts, and particularly from many teachers, and certainly the teachers' union, are seen as shaping the next generation of voters. And I think this is one reason why, as I said, every parent should ask themselves, and that doesn't mean they're all going to homeschool, but they should at least ask whether their children are being educated in ways that align with their values.
You just hit something really, really hard. We're talking to Delano Squires. He is a research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He's also a contributor to Blaze Media. I've done a lot of interviews on this subject, and nobody has ever said what you just said when you said that schools are being used to affirm the identities, and I thought you were going to say of kids, whatever they think their identity is. You said they're being used to affirm the identities of adults. Mm-hmm. They are using kids to make them feel like their identities, whether they be, you know, sexual orientation identities or gender identities or whatever it is that they identify as, they're trying to normalize it with kids to make themselves feel like they're okay.
Right, and this is why, you know, when there was the fake controversy around the so-called Don't Say Gay bill, it was all about adults saying, well, how am I going to tell kids about, you know, what me and my husband — this would be a male teacher speaking — what me and my husband did for the weekend. It's like, well, that's not a child's concern, right? The children are not there to hear about you and your personal life. So, and this is one of the reasons that I think people need to understand why these initiatives that are framed as diversity, equity, and inclusion are so toxic, is because they don't really deliver what it is that is promised, right? For the left, diversity is a bunch of people who look different but all think the same. You know, inclusion is about, again, forcing people to, you know, affirm whatever identity you choose for yourself that day. And equity is sold as giving everyone what they need so that they can reach their potential and so that people can all get to the same place. But what's measured is whether every person, every student ends up in the same place you know, regardless of where they start from. And the effect is never to raise the floor. It's always to lower the ceiling. So, you know, this is what the left does. And I think
well said.
This is why it's so dangerous. And I want to say something really quick, because I think this is often framed in such a way where people think that only certain parents, particularly, you know, white, middle-class, upwardly mobile parents, oppose this stuff. I'm a black guy who went to New York City public school, who lives in the Washington, D.C. area, you know, with my wife and my four kids, and I hate this stuff because of how it teaches white students to think about themselves, but also how it teaches black students to think about themselves as perpetual victims and always oppressed and marginalized. And all of that stuff, I think, is garbage that does not have any educational purpose. All it does is give students complexes. It lowers their self-esteem. It worsens their sense of self-image. It creates tension between people who would otherwise be friends. And none of the students are actually learning anything.
Yeah, it's classical Marxism. It's exactly what you just described as classical Marxism. And I think you're spot on. And by the way, I'm so glad to hear you identify your graduation year is 2000, and you didn't see any of that stuff. I taught school about 10 years before that. I taught English and junior and senior high schools, and my kids didn't know if I was married unless they saw, because I coached football, unless they saw my wife at a game, maybe. But nobody talked about their private lives. Nobody talked about their marital situations or what they did with their girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever. I mean, you're there to teach kids about what your subject matter is. And the idea that they feel like they have to have these connections so that these kids feel like they can be supported in whatever their lives are like is just, it is just so dangerous. Let's get to the DEI at the university level that you wrote this great piece about that prompted our reach out to you today. There's a line, a terrific piece, by the way, but I just wanted to focus on one, particularly when it comes to inclusion, the part of DEI or DIE. Princeton's diversity office includes several people with they pronouns, in addition to several positions focused on sexual orientation and gender identity. I doubt that people who believe there are only two sexes feel very welcomed on campus, end quote. That's you. Mm-hmm. And it's just so important to say that, because inclusivity, by its very nature, is exclusive. By trying to make these people feel included, if they are all about gender identity and you can be a cat, a dog, or a, you know, two things or whatever it is you want, people who are just he, him, and she, her, and don't want to have to identify that because it should be obvious they're male and female, they don't feel included. They are, by definition, being excluded from the new clubs that are being formed.
Absolutely, and you see this all the time, you know, with these types of issues. I saw an article yesterday about some, you know, new online bookstore that was associated with drag queens, and it was a controversy because they removed certain book titles from Matt Walsh and Riley Gaines and you know, other conservatives. So these are the people who said, oh, this is book banning, and then they turn around, and when they have their platform, which they say is supposed to be inclusive, they do the very thing that they accuse others of. So
I think it was a RuPaul thing. I think it was her initiative his initiative, I should say. See what they do? They get you into that game.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. They oh my gosh, this is a list of all of the books that the, you know, conservative right is trying to ban. So we're giving them out for free, but we're not going to give out any of the books that we hate. We're banning those. It's just incredibly, they're so self unaware.
Exactly, and I actually think that's a feature. Progressivism and not a bug, but yeah, these campuses are out of control with these initiatives. One, I don't think that they're needed. There's nowhere that is more accommodating to young people of any ethnic background than a college campus. I actually think the inmates are running the asylum in many of these places. But as I said, and I had other examples, the associate dean of diversity for the Stanford Law School joined students who shouted down a speaker who was invited to speak to the law school.
A judge.
She talked about, a judge, a federal judge. And she talked about how he was causing harm and, you know, his decisions went against their marginalized identities and also, you know, finger snapping from the students. Because what we've done over the last, I'd say, at least three generations is create a crop of students who are the most anxious, neurotic, self-obsessed narcissists that probably have ever walked the face of the earth. Children who have every material comfort and technological advance find a way to see themselves as oppressed and marginalized, cannot even bear to hear someone express a viewpoint that's slightly different than their own. And these are the people who say that they're for diversity and inclusion. So these programs don't deliver what they promise, force ideological conformity, and then they lead to massive bureaucracies that cost millions and millions and millions of dollars. And I'm assuming all of those costs at some point are passed down to the parents and students who pay to be there.
No question about it. And you know what matters a lot here in this conversation, too? We're talking with Delano Squires, research fellow at the Heritage Foundation, contributor to Blaze Media. It's important that you're a black guy, and it shouldn't be, but this is kind of the point here. Those who are opposing the elimination of DEI are literally saying things, and you include this in your work as well. People like Roland Martin and social commentator Lawrence Ross. Now, I'm not familiar with him. I'm assuming he is also a black guy. I know Roland Martin is. But you write, Roland Martin and social commentator Lawrence Ross suggested that black athletes should leave schools that have eliminated DEI programs. Ross went so far as to say that the University of Florida, which has done this, doesn't see black athletes as human. I mean, that is so beyond, pardon this bad pun, but that's beyond the pale to say that. But this is what they believe, and they're literally trying to make black people be the focal point of this. So as a black man, you speaking out in the way that you are is extraordinarily important, much more than I could ever do.
Yeah, and when I see, I get frustrated with people like that because, you know, they are cultivating a sense of, as I said, anxiety and neuroticism, particularly among young black men, that's completely unnecessary. They're training them to be afraid of boogeymen, and I don't think that that's helpful. And obviously, it's hyperbole, and you know, it's nowhere near the truth that the University of Florida doesn't see black students as for human. So there is sort of that sense on the left of going to the extremes. But I will say this: there is also a danger on the right, and that is to be so against everything associated with leftism and everything associated with DEI that the very fact of seeing someone, let's say a black woman, in a cockpit practicing, you know, doing her hours to get her, you know, her license to fly is branded as, oh, that's another DEI initiative. Absent any other evidence, any other, you know, suggestion that this person is unqualified, it's the very fact of seeing someone who looks different and assuming that they are being let in under a lower standard. That is the temptation and the danger on the right. And I think one of the ways...
Permit me to challenge that for just a moment.
Okay, sure,
I agree with you when you say no one, no matter what your perspective is and where you are on the scale, no one should assume that this person is a diversity hire and not qualified. But questioning it, I think, is fair. And that's what Charlie Kirk did after United Air, who said, made an announcement, their CEO, that 50% of our pilots being hired from this point forward are going to be people of color or women. And so Charlie Kirk said, all that does is make me get on a plane. And if I see a black pilot up there, I have to wonder, is this person the best of the best and is going to keep me and everybody else here safe? Or is this person less than the best, but they got here because United committed to diversifying their pilot staff or their crew? So the questions, I think, are going to be brought up in their minds because of what they have done through DEI. And it's not our fault if we have those questions wondering, are you a real? Same thing. If I'm going in for surgery, I'm sure you'd agree, Delano, if I'm going in for surgery, am I going to know that the surgeon here is the very best to do what is going to save my life or perhaps take my life? Or is this somebody, because medical school said we need more color on the campus? We need more gay. We need more women. We need more, you know, people in our schools to fit that DEI, you know, checkbox or checklist, I should say. And so even if they're not the best, man, we got to get them in here. And now how do we know who we're getting treated by? Those questions are going to come up no matter who you are.
Yeah, and I understand that, and I understand human nature, right? When someone makes that type of commitment, I think companies are completely out of bounds for doing this. I think it's actually quite counterproductive. The company could do
it is.
They could do the same thing and just not announce it so that you don't attach that stigma to the person. Mm-hmm. But I understand that response, all right, and that pushback. But again, the present. I'll say it this way. I'll explain it this way. I'm for diversity that is wider net diversity and not lower bar. And to me, one of the greatest examples, it's funny that because it actually has to do with aviation, of wider net diversity of the Tuskegee Airmen, who at one point were barred from being aviators in the U.S. military because of their skin color.
Mm-hmm.
And at a certain point, there's an initiative set forth to open up those opportunities to a group of black men, and they trained hard, but they were admitted with standards that were just as high as for their white counterparts. And even though the notion that they never lost a plane, a plane in World War II is not exactly true, right? They don't have to be perfect in order to be respected. And they went on, the Tuskegee Airmen went on to win the Air Force's first, so-called Top Gun competition in the late 1940s. So to me, that is wider net diversity, which is to say opening opportunities to people who may not have otherwise had them.
Lower I think that's well said.
Right. The lower bar diversity, which I think is what most people on the right oppose, is saying we want more people of a particular identity group, whether it's, skin color or sexuality, and we are willing to either waive, lower, alter, and alter always almost means lower, standards. In order to make that goal and to make it fit. And I'm completely against that for all the reasons that you said. It diminishes the quality of the products being offered, but it also strips the people who are quote unquote benefiting of their dignity and agency.
Yes.
And it tells them and the broader society that we don't really think that you're up to snuff. And that is one of the reasons that I oppose it so vehemently, because I know what it does, so that now you could be a black person or a woman who's at the top of your class, but because somebody else said, oh, we're going to lower standards for these people, everybody else is going to question your credentials. And I think the most important thing to realize is that the people who benefit most from these initiatives, and particularly from publicizing them, are the institutions and individuals who get to claim credit for believing in diversity, equity, and inclusion. Those are the people who benefit the most.
100%. And the most important line you just said, by the way, about the Tuskegee Airmen is they did not lower the standards. They widened the
Correct.
Net. They did not lower the bar. And that's exactly right. And let's close it with going back to the sports part of this thing. Again, you wrote mm-hmm. about athletes. I talked about how they don't, what Ross said about black athletes. DEI, if properly applied to black athletes or just athletes in general, if it was properly applied, there would be 4- and 5-star black athletes who would not be on teams because a 2-star Asian needs to be on the team to get the diversity numbers right. And a number of Hispanics, and who knows, and maybe even a transgender one or two, because we've got to be diverse. Right? I mean, and do you want a transgender right tackle protecting your 5-star, soon-to-be multi-million-dollar quarterback because we got to make the team roster look diversified? If they apply this in all aspects of it, they, of course, would realize how stupid it is. So why isn't it stupid for the others?
That is a fantastic point. And I think one of the reasons we don't apply it to sports is because people actually desire a meritocracy. And then also everybody understands, what you said, what we're talking about, which is when you change standards, you ultimately lower them. And no one wants to see, the guys who are down in the rec center playing in the NBA. No, we want the top athletes. So to your point, I think we should be equitable and impartial and consistent in our application of that standard. And that's why I think that DEI needs to DIE.
I think that is brilliantly stated. Great article. I'm going to link it up. I may have already done it, but follow Delano Squires on Twitter as well, Twitter X. He is at Delano, just like it sounds, D-E-L-A-N-O Squires. Follow him on Twitter, and I'm going to continue to do that, and hopefully we can have you back on again. I really enjoyed the conversation.
So did I. Thanks, sir.
Thank you very much. All right, that's Delano Squires from Blaze Media and the Heritage Foundation. It's 9:58. We're going to get a timeout. When we come back, we're going to have two good things. We're going to have Peter Kersenow, and we may have the ability to carry a little bit of the Robert
commitment Wayne County needs in Columbus. Vote Bill Albright on or before March 19th.
I'm Bill Albright, and I approve this message.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
This is Always Right Radio on AM 1420, The Answer. Here's your host, Bob France.
All right, hour number two underway now. It's 8 minutes past 10 o'clock on this Tuesday. It's a Kersenau day, but it's also a Jordan day for the moment anyway. We're going to be going bebopping back in and out of the Robert Hur testimony. Here's a little bit of Chairman Jordan of the Judiciary Committee's opening statement getting this hearing underway.
That President Biden willfully retained and disclosed classified materials after his vice presidency when he was a private citizen. He further writes, Mr. Biden willfully retained marked classified documents about Afghanistan and handwritten notes in his notebooks, which he stored in unsecure places in his home. Joe Biden kept classified information, and Joe Biden failed to store classified information properly. Mr. Hur made these determinations after interviewing 147 witnesses. He examined 7 million documents, including emails, text messages, photographs, videos, toll records, and other materials from both classified and unclassified sources. But there's more. Joe Biden not only kept information he wasn't allowed to keep, and he not only failed to secure that information properly, he also shared it with people who weren't allowed to see it. Shared that information with his ghostwriter.
And pretty damning account here of everything that Robert Hur did report. Jim Jordan, of course, just getting started on listing some of what the facts are in the Hur report. Of course, we will then hear from the minority leader of that committee. Then we will hear the opening statement of Robert Hur, and that's the one we're probably going to want to peek in a little bit on and get Peter Kersenau's reaction to. So for now, let's bring in our good friend Peter Kersenau, a Cleveland attorney, a member of the United States Commission on Civil Rights, an author, a columnist, and, of course, a law professor as well. Peter Kersenau, welcome back, my friend. Good morning.
Beautiful day in Cleveland, Bob. I'm psyched. You know, it kind of gives us a taste of the summer to come.
Yeah, a little bit. It's going to be in the 60s today. That is very, very nice. It's an interesting day in Washington, D.C., our nation's capital now, where we are going to hear from the man that wrote the report that said, yeah, he broke all kinds of laws. He violated all kinds of rules. He did all kinds of stuff, and he did so willingly. But he shouldn't be charged because no jury would convict a kind old man with good intentions and a really poor memory. Pete, that's the crux of what Robert Hur said. Obviously, Jim Jordan, James Comer, and others on the committee and on the oversight committee, they want to know very specifically what Joe Biden said. They want the transcript. They want the recordings of all of the interviews that were done with Joe Biden. They have subpoenaed them, but for now they're going to have to rely on Robert Hur's testimony today. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a surprise. We heard a little bit of this before. But again, it bears repeating that the opening statement from a guy who was chosen by the Biden Justice Department to lead this investigation, who doesn't at least appear to have any political axe to grind, although the Democrats, I'm sure, are going to find out that when he was in kindergarten, he once had a, you know, Nixon sticker or something. But it's a damning report, and we have to take it extremely seriously. Yes, I cannot stand Joe Biden. But put that aside. This is the President of the United States of America who is too cognitively impaired to even testify on his own behalf, yet he's charged with being the Commander-in-Chief of the United States of America in a time when we've got multiple threats marching across the landscape. And not just military threats, but, you know, threats to the integrity of our constitutional system, threats to our economy, so on and so forth. And what Biden did, at least according to her, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt, the Democrats wouldn't do this and the media wouldn't do it, but I repeat myself, if it was Trump. But it appears, by all evidence, and we saw photographic evidence of some of it, that he retained documents that he did not have a legal right to possess. And contrast that with President Trump, who had a legal right to possess these documents. He had the ability to declassify them. Yet they went and raided the former president's residence, treated him as a common criminal. I'm sure a lot of people were cheering that because they will say, yes, he's a common criminal. But all the evidence shows that Biden, throughout his tenure in Congress and in the president, and at least in the vice presidency, is the common criminal. Not just common, he's uncommon in terms of collaborating with foreign powers. And regardless of what the media and the Democrats, by repeat myself, clamor about and try to obfuscate, the very plain evidence is this guy was dealing with bad actors on a regular basis, and not just dealing with them consciously, but he did so, you know, as we saw the manner in which some of these documents were kept. And by the way, you know, I regularly, with my family for the last 30 years, been vacationing very near Biden's residence. It is, you know, it's right on the shore there. It is an easy place if you had bad intentions to infiltrate. Very, very easy. You're right there on the shore. There's a shore. There's a, you know, the coastal highway is next to it. It's just extraordinary that he would allow this to happen and leave it in the custody of his idiot son. In addition to that, his drug-addled son. This is a national security nightmare. But we're treating it as if, you know, he just forgot to put the cat out. It's a sign, as Victor Davis Hanson and others would say, of the really fundamental decline of the United States of America in service of a man who doesn't deserve it. So there's a lot to be said here. I don't expect the press to be covering this fairly at all. I don't think they're going to be responsible at all. That's no surprise for all of your listeners out there who came to that conclusion a long time ago. But history will record this. And again, because history, the first draft, is written by the media, it won't necessarily emerge for a while. But your listeners, and we know many of them, you know, we've met them in various scenarios. Mm-hmm. They're smart enough to get it. They understand that this isn't something that happened in American history before, that this is something that's extraordinarily important, and we shouldn't just slough it off as, it's Joe Biden. No, this is incredibly important, and believe your own eyes and ears, which I know 99% of your listeners will do when you say that, or when they say that this is a monumental event that unfortunately is being diminished and tainted and distorted by the Democrats and media, but I repeat myself.
Yeah, and you know what's one of the most frustrating things? You said, you know, they're going to dig back into Robert Hur and try to discredit him with Nixon stickers and whatnot. But the reality is, according to everything that I've read and everything that I've heard, he is absolutely not anywhere near conservative, right-wing, even right-leaning. As a matter of fact, that he kind of cut his legal chops at the feet of one of the most left-leaning attorneys in Washington. So this is a guy who's not going to be able to be painted as some sort of anti-Biden. You know, Jordan isn't calling him up here to sing his praises. Jordan called him here and subpoenaed him to testify here to say, why the hell didn't you charge him? You said all of this was willful. You pointed out he didn't have the right to declassify these things the way Trump did with the documents in Mar-a-Lago. You talked about him doing this as a senator, too. So why didn't you charge him? So the left is going to be there saying, why did you speak so harshly of our president and talk about this cognitive decline thing that plays into the right, narrative? You know, why would you do such a thing? And Jordan's there to say, why didn't you finish the job? You know what he did was illegal. You know it was willful. You know it was intentional. For crying out loud, he kept him in the garage next to the Corvette that he let Hunter drive. And that means right. Hunter, a crackhead, an admitted crack addict who has many, many contacts with foreign adversaries and companies in nations that are not friends with the United States, he's got access to classified documents. Then who knows if he's selling off for profit to buy more crack? All of those things are why classified documents have to be kept secure. And so why didn't you charge this guy? You really going to go with the jury's going to feel too sympathetic because he's got a bad memory? They can't do that. And Robert Hur is going to be kind of taking it from both sides today, but only one side actually is interested in justice.
Yeah, he will be taking it from both sides. I'm glad I'm not Robert Hur today. He had a tough job, and I bet when he undertook the job, he understood precisely what he was getting himself into. And the best thing to do when you're in that situation, whether you're Republican, Democrat, or Independent, is play it right down the middle, because you're not going to get friends on either side of the aisle. Now, in this particular case, you're right that I think the Republicans are going to be treating him a little bit better than the Democrats will, but either way, it's a hot seat that I don't think anybody in America really wants to be on. Bottom line, though, is Robert Hur, all due respect to him, is a bit player in all of this. This is about Joe Biden and the selling of the United States, the selling out of the United States. And it's extraordinary that a president would be in a position like this. I can't remember any situation like this. I'm not saying that I know all history, but, you know, I'm at least as well versed in presidential history as the next guy. And this is something that is truly extraordinary, especially when you consider all of the other evidence independent of what was being stored in Delaware. And that is that we have multiple instances of the Biden family getting money from overseas. And the real question is, despite the fact that the Democrats are very good at obfuscation and misdirection, is they got millions of dollars. Bob, have you ever gotten millions of dollars from Ukraine or China or any of these other places? I haven't. And among other things is I don't know what they would be paying for because I don't produce a product and there's no service I can provide right. to them. I'm a lawyer. So what are the Bidens, who are some of the most incompetent people, whether or not you know they're lawyers or anything else, they're just simply bubbleheads. What were they selling? What products were they selling? What was Biden Inc. selling? What widgets were they selling? What services were there? Maid services? Cleaning services? Where are they sent? But they're getting money directly from government actors of the worst enemies the America has. And yet the media simply don't care. And if they, to the extent they do care, they lie about it. We are in extraordinary times. Again, I want to keep bringing up Victor Davis Hanson, but when Victor Davis Hanson gets as alarmed as he is and writes almost in a hysterical fashion for Victor, take note. But you just don't have to look to Victor. Anybody over the age of 12 can look around at what's going on and says, we're in dire straits right now, and especially when you look at the longitudinal view of U.S. history.
Well, you know, going back to your core question there about, you know, what were the Bidens selling, you know, and the answer was nothing except access, you know, to the White House. I think every single foreign policy decision that Barack Obama made during the Obama-Biden years should be scrutinized, investigated, and to determine whether or not there was any undue influence being made because Joe Biden did favors for or got into the ear of Barack Obama for some of Hunter's business associates. We know about Shokin. We know about Ukraine because they basically bragged about it. You know, Joe Biden, I should say, bragged about it. We all have heard it numerous times of, you know, the story about how he went to, here, let's just hit it again real quick.
I went over, I guess, the 12th, 13th time to Kyiv, and I was supposed to announce that there was another $1 billion loan guarantee. And I had gotten a commitment from Poroshenko and from Yatsenyuk that they would take action against the state prosecutor, and they didn't. So they said they were walking out to press conference. I said, I'm not going to, we're not going to give you the $1 billion. They said, you have no authority. You're not the president. The president said, I said, call him. I said, I'm telling you, you're not getting $1 billion. I said, you're not getting $1 billion. I'm going to be leaving here. And I think it was, 6 hours. I said, I'm leaving in 6 hours. If the prosecutor's not fired, you're not getting the money. Well, son of a bitch. Got fired. And they put in place someone who was solid.
So quite literally, that's an example of Biden saying, I got you. Call him. Call him, he said. Call my boss. Call Barack and see if I don't have the authority to do this. And Barack did what Joe wanted him to do, and he got fired. So I think everything, Peter, every foreign policy decision that was ever made by the Obama administration ought to be investigated to find out exactly how much influence Joe was wielding on behalf of his son and, you know, the Biden crime syndicate, you know, that was making all that money.
I agree entirely. I've been saying it for a long time. Having said that, and I'm not saying it shouldn't be done, but having said that, as you and I and your listeners know, it's probably not going to go anywhere for several reasons. Number one is I don't think that the Republican House has the bandwidth to do it, even though it is extraordinarily important. But it doesn't have the bandwidth when viewed in conjunction with the fact that Democrats in the media, by repeat myself, will be obfuscating, will be stonewalling, will be saying, waving their hands, saying nothing to see here, trying to make fools and making life miserable and destroying careers as a result of it. And also, the genius of what, if you want to call it genius, of what the Merrick Garlands and the Bidens and Democrats generally do, they know that their handmaidens in the media will not be snooping around the way they do with Republicans. So they can string this out for years, literally years, until the fulcrum of the investigation is long since passed and people will forget about it. There's other issues that will come up. You know, mark my words, we've seen it before. Mm-hmm. So that's what they're going to try to do, string it out until such time as whoever's in office no longer has the zeal to pursue this. People don't care about it. Other issues come up that's going to capture the attention of voters. So there's a very real probability that no one's going to be held to account for this. Robert Hur is probably going to get the most discomfort of anybody in the United States as a result of all this. And then we're just simply going to move along, especially in an election year. The Democrats have a job to do, and that is to protect the Democrats and, most importantly, right now, the Biden family.
Yeah, and Robert Hur, that's why no matter what happens today, Robert Hur needs to come forth with those recordings and those transcripts, and they need to be released to the American people immediately. Because the American people need to know exactly what's going on with the man that they are considering giving another term
right.
in just 8 months. And so they need to know. Well, you know, Robert Hur said his memory is really shot. Let's find the evidence of that. Joe Biden said, I've never forgot anything about my son. You know, look at this rosary I wear. I got from Our Lady of... I don't know. So, you know, in the reality is, according to her and according to witnesses that were there, you know, Joe Biden's, you know, with his indignation that how dare he even bring up my son? He didn't. Joe Biden brought him up. Joe Biden brought him up, according to Robert Hur. And when he did, he couldn't even come within a period of years as to when his son died. He didn't know what year. And it wasn't like being one off. It was years plural that he was not even within a range of. So. We deserve to know exactly how bad it is, and we deserve to know exactly if it is that bad that he can't stand trial. It wouldn't be a fair trial because he is such a, you know, mentally, you know, declining individual. Then how can he serve another term as president with that same scope? So, by the way, Peter, I'm monitoring this as you and I are talking, and Seth just told me that Jerry Nadler, in his opening remarks, spent the entire time talking about Trump. And comparing Biden's documents to Trump's. Well, you know, I saw clips
at
least of Trump,
wasn't
too.
Wasn't talking about the food tray, you know. That's
but you know what's so aggravating about this, Peter, is, okay, let's compare the Biden to Trump. Trump had the right to declassify his.
Yep.
Biden did not. And Trump is facing dozens of felony charges for it, and Biden gets off scot-free. Thanks. Comparison over, Jerry.
Yep. That's exactly right. And, you know, what we have here is another example of how the deep state FBI, the intelligence services, have been corrupted. And I hate to say that. You know, and I'm not talking about everybody. I'm not talking about everybody. Right now, as we speak, I'm looking at the FBI building from my office. But clearly, at the upper levels, in many respects, we've had a corrupted system. And it's dispiriting to those of us Republicans and conservatives who looked to them to protect the interests of America and the Americans within it. But that's not what's happening here.
Yeah, that's very well said. Peter, we'll take a time out here. You and I can both watch a little bit of the hearing. James Comer is giving his opening statement now, and we'll be getting to Robert Hur's opening statement shortly. We'll probably take some of Robert's
State Health Insurance Program to get information on all of your options.
Keeping you in the uninformed. Always Right Radio with Bob France on The Answer.
All right, it's a Kersenow day, so ordinarily I would not cut into Peter Kersenow's talk time, but I do want him to react a little bit to what I'm about to play. I paused the hearing in Washington, D.C. at the very beginning of Robert Hur's opening statement, so let's listen to a couple minutes of that and get Kersenow's thoughts on it.
Chairman Jordan, Ranking Member Nadler, Chairman Comer, Ranking Member Raskin, members of the committee, good morning. I'm privileged to have served our country for the majority of my career, a decade and a half, most of those years with the Department of Justice. I have served as a line prosecutor, a supervisor, the principal associate deputy attorney general, a United States attorney, and a special counsel. I've served in these roles with gratitude as the son of immigrants to this country, the first member of my family to be born here. My parents grew up in Korea, and were young children during the Korean War. My father remembers being hungry and grateful for the food that American GIs shared with him and his siblings. My mother fled what is now North Korea in her own mother's arms, heading south to safety. My parents eventually met, married, and came to the U.S., seeking a better life for themselves and for their children. Their lives and mine would have been very different were it not for this country. No matter the role, no matter the administration, I have applied the same standards and the same impartiality My respect for the Justice Department and my commitment to this country are why I agreed to serve as special counsel when asked by the Attorney General. I resolved to do the work as I did all my work for the department, fairly, thoroughly.
Okay, a lot of this looks like it's just kind of introductory and procedural, and that's okay, but I want to skip ahead just a little bit here to get something of substance for Pete and I to talk about here.
That I recommended no criminal charges and leave it at that.
Here we go.
I needed to explain why. My report reflects my best effort to explain why I declined to recommend charging President Biden. I analyzed the evidence as prosecutors routinely do by assessing its strengths and weaknesses, including by anticipating the ways in which the president's defense lawyers might poke holes in the government's case, if there were a trial, and seek to persuade jurors that the government could not prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. There has been a lot of attention paid to language in the report about the president's memory, so let me say a few words about that.
This is big.
My task was to determine whether the president retained or disclosed national defense information willfully. That means knowingly and with the intent to do something the law forbids. I could not make that determination without assessing the president's state of mind. For that reason, I had to consider the president's memory and overall mental state and how a jury likely would perceive his memory and mental state in a criminal trial. These are the types of issues that prosecutors analyze every day. And because these issues were important to my ultimate decision, I had to include a discussion of them in my report to the Attorney General. The evidence and the president himself put his memory squarely at issue. We interviewed the president and asked him about his recorded statement. Quote, I just found all the classified stuff downstairs, end quote. He told us that he didn't remember saying that to his ghostwriter. He also said he didn't remember finding any classified material in his home after his vice presidency. And he didn't remember anything about how classified documents about Afghanistan made their way into his garage. My assessment in the report about the relevance of the president's memory was necessary and accurate and fair. Most importantly, what I wrote is what I believe the evidence shows and what I expect jurors would perceive and believe. I did not sanitize my explanation, nor did I disparage the president unfairly. I explained to the Attorney General my decision and the reasons for it. That's what I was required to do. I took the same approach when I compared the evidence regarding President Biden to the department's allegations against former President Trump. There, too, I called it like I saw it. As a prosecutor, I had to consider relevant precedents and to explain why different facts justify different outcomes. That is what I did in my report. I'm confident the analysis set forth in chapters 11, 12, and 13 of my report provides a thorough evaluation and explanation of the evidence, and I encourage everyone to read it to inform their opinions of the report. Prosecutors rarely write public reports or testify about their investigations.
Okay.
That is the Justice Department's longstanding policy.
I'm going to mute this for now and just get some quick reactions from Kersenow. He's laying out pretty much what he said he was going to, in the pre-released testimony of his opening statement, and it's pretty much what he what was reported by the media. I would say, strangely enough, when he actually wrote his report, they characterized it as Biden being completely mentally declining when it comes to his memory. But because of that, you can't really apply intent. You know, it's certainly not beyond the reasonable doubt for a jury because he is so indeed cognitively declining. So, Pete, your thoughts? What you've heard so far?
Yeah. Well. Obviously, he's anticipating the nature of the attacks that he's going to be receiving, and they're going to be furious and plentiful.
Yeah.
And it's mainly going to come, obviously, from the Democrats because he has really damned Joe Biden. I mean, Joe Biden, if you look at the report, again, there's no evidence of any bias from this guy, although they'll try to assign bias all over the place. they'll claim that, you know, since his mother escaped from North Korea, and this is plausible, she's probably extremely conservative, who loves this country passionately and understands that you shouldn't be going down the track that Democrats are going down if you don't want to have a totalitarian government that she escaped from. I understand that because my family thinks the same way. But, you know, that's a fool's proposition if the Raskins of the world or anyone else wants to attack him on that basis. I think it will boomerang. But he's laying forth the basis for why this report is credible, and he looked at it, and he sounds like he understood the vice grip he was going to be in when given this assignment. There's nothing good that comes out of this for him unless he wants to write some kind of biography, and I don't even know if that's going to do much good. So this is a thankless job, to put it very mildly. And he's anticipating attacks, and I think he's doing it very, very well. So we'll see what happens. We know what the report says, and the report doesn't do Biden any favors whatsoever, and I'm putting that extremely mildly.
Well, that's why they spent so much time. That's why they spent so much time, Nadler and anybody else in the open on the left, going after Trump, saying Trump was worse. Trump was worse.
Yeah,
asking too.
Trump was not worse. And Trump was treated differently. And Trump was president of the United States at the time, and afterwards he was president of the United States. Biden had no right to have that information in the first place. That's the big difference. He had no right to retain that personally as vice president, place it in such a negligent position, and that's putting that mildly also, in his garage next to his precious Corvette along the coastal. Look, as I've said before, I know exactly where that is, and I know the ease of access, especially when this guy was not in office. When he was not in office and his derelict son was there doing who knows what, the ease of access there was, if any of the people who write novels like I do were to write a scenario like this, it would be too facile. That is, it would be too easy to believe that enemies of the United States of America would be left this bountiful, a treasure trove of classified material. That would be too easy. Yet that's precisely what the crackhead son of the president did. This is an incredible breach, and no matter how much the Democrats and media, but I repeat myself, try to downplay it, Americans have a responsibility to treat it with the gravity that it deserves. And look, I'm partisan. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. But if you're the most neutral human being on the face of the earth, you have to look at this with incredible astonishment and alarm that this was permitted to happen. And the United States of America doesn't have appropriate protocols set up to prevent an addlehead vice president from taking documents like this.
Well, not only that, the potential of him taking documents, but the fact that, and this was covered in the opening remarks, he gave documents to the ghostwriter. Now, I don't know who the ghostwriter was. I don't know how trustworthy he was. It doesn't matter. He doesn't have security clearance. If you don't have security clearance, you're going to be Joe Biden's best friend. You can be Joe Biden and still not have security clearance to see classified, much less top secret documents. And he handed those to a ghostwriter to help him write a memoir that he could not possibly write himself without plagiarizing, because we heard all of his speeches, all of his career. The only thing he can write was written by somebody else first. So he gives all of that to a ghostwriter. How does he know what the ghostwriter did with that stuff? How do we know the ghostwriter doesn't have a profit motive of his own and say, I can make some Xerox, I can do some scans, I can do some pictures with my phone, whatever, and send these out to whoever I want to? The fact that he gave those to somebody else automatically means he needs to be charged, Peter. Not just, well, I left him in a box in the garage haphazardly, and I don't even remember doing it, and I don't know why I gave him to the Penn Biden Center that was owned by the Chinese, and all of this other stuff. He gave them willfully to another person without classified, without clearance, security clearance, and that to me ought to be enough to be actionable.
Right, no doubt it's willful. There's no doubt about that. He gave them to another party. He didn't just kind of casually take these documents. May have been in his briefcase along with something else, although I don't know under what circumstance that could ever happen. Look, I'm not involved in classified materials at that level, but I know this much. I've been involved in a lot of confidential material. That kind of stuff does not happen unless you are incredibly, negligent is not, you are reckless disregard for national security, or you are brain dead stupid. And with Biden, it could be both. And I don't mean to say that pejoratively. We've seen the evidence of it, and this is so important that you can't edge your bets on this kind of thing. National security is at risk, and we know that not only did he act recklessly, but this individual, as opposed to, let's say, any other person who holds public office who may have done something similar, and I don't know of anybody who's ever done anything like that, the difference is this family regularly consorts with the prime enemies of the United States of America for money. Mike, you couldn't make this kind of stuff
up. That's right.
Yet the media and Democrats, by repeat myself, downplay this. And I will say this again, my pet peeve about many Republicans, although I think Jim Jordan and others are doing yeoman's work considering the kind of blowback they get regularly, but Republicans need to, get plumb mad dog mean and go absolutely ape you know what, despite what the media does, despite what Democrats do, because this is about the United States of America. The Democrats and media, by I repeat myself, will look at anything that a Republican does. If they sneeze the wrong way, they're accusing them of spreading AIDS or anything all over the place.
Yeah.
You know? But if Democrats compromise the national security of the United States, it's like, well, move along, nothing to see here. We can't continue to have a functioning republic under that two-tiered system of media coverage and the two-tiered system of justice that this Justice Department has been implementing.
Yeah. Peter, Kelly Armstrong, Republican from North Dakota, has been questioning her first, and he looks rather animated. I'm going to play a little bit of this so we can see what the questions and answers are and get a response.
Report. He has been, and we heard all about exonerated and all of those different things. It appears from the report he met every actual element of the crime. So I want to talk about the department principles on federal prosecution, because that actually has nothing to do with the underlying elements, correct? It's whether or not you can prove this at trial.
Under the department's justice manual and the principles of federal prosecution, a prosecutor has to assess the evidence and determine whether, in his or her judgment, the probable outcome will be a conviction at trial.
So whether or not you meet the elements of the crime, which I think it's clear that he does, the second part of this is this, and that's where it gets into the sympathetic, well-meaning, elderly man with a poor memory. You could have just said we don't prosecute sitting presidents, but you did not. And you enter this, but that doesn't have anything to do with the actual elements of the crime. That has to do with getting a conviction at trial, correct?
Well, Congressman, part and parcel of a prosecutor's judgment as to whether or not a conviction is the probable outcome of trial is assessing how the evidence identified during the investigation lines up with the elements and what proof can be offered to a jury during a trial.
Sure, but his well-meaning elderly old man has nothing to do with the underlying elements of the crime.
Well, it certainly has some
presentation to the jury.
It certainly has something
back. Gentleman can respond.
It certainly has something to do with the way that a jury is going to perceive and receive and consider and make conclusions based on evidence at trial, Congressman.
Okay, so Pete, if you want to weigh in on that, again, from a legal standpoint, you heard Armstrong speaking very specifically about the elements of the crime, which he must have laid out as you and I were talking, and all of those indicate that, yes, he certainly was chargeable based on the elements of the crime, and you chose not to because of the senile, old, friendly, but bad memory guy there, and that's the reason. And he said it's because I couldn't get a conviction with that. Can you shine any light on that from your legal perspective?
No, not really. I can't. I think it speaks for itself, frankly. I don't need to embellish it or elaborate any more, except to say that, and I'll point to, again, the different standards to which the Trump and Biden are being held. But put Trump aside, going back to our previous conversation, what we're talking about here must not be diminished. This is extraordinary what transpired. Truly extraordinary. And frankly, I don't think the Republicans are approaching with the kind of alarm that they should. We have so, I think, debased standards of patriotism in this country that we're letting things such as this go flying by as if it's a mere administrative, you know, glitch, that somehow he did something negligently and, you know, just move on, nothing more to see here. We're just using this for some little political fodder. This is a big deal. And it's also, in terms of political fodder, I think it confirms everything, as if we need more confirmation, but it does so in a much more serious fashion, the fact that Joe Biden, even before he became as enfeebled as he is right now, was not the brightest bulb in the world, was not somebody who had national security at the, as people like to say these days, top of mind. I hate that phrase, but I'll use it because people have been using it. And yet he's running for office again. Shame on us if we return somebody like this to office. We have alternatives to this. And whether or not you like Trump, there's under no circumstances can you equate the actions of Biden to Trump. And just imagine if, aside from this kind of negligent action, if Trump had gotten 10 cents from the People's Republic of China, or anybody remotely associated therewith. My goodness. But the Bidens, millions, move along, nothing to see here. And it's really despicable that an entire cohort of the media and Democrats, but I repeat myself, would simply go along, that is, derogate the interests of the United States of America, regardless of what your party is, to political imperative, truly despicable, folks. I can't imagine at any other point in history that either party would stoop to such lows.
Well, I don't know about the last part, either party, but obviously does.
Even this one, though, this is extraordinary. I can't see a Kennedy doing something like this.
Well, that party's not here anymore, though, right, Pete?
Yeah,
that party is not here anymore. I mean, I've been talking in the last couple of days on this show and others, about the Republican Party, which, by the way, is being completely rebuilt at the RNC level. Some 60 staffers have been fired now that the new sheriffs in town, Watley and Laura Trump, are running the show now. But the Republican Party of 2024 is not even the Republican Party of the early 2000s. I mean, this isn't the party that gave us McCain and Mitt. It is a very different thing now, and I like to think it's better. It might not be as popular because we're not winning elections or not winning them by nearly enough, but it's better. The Democrats, completely different. The party of Kennedy you're talking about, even the party of the Clinton years, long gone. This is so much more extreme and so much more radical than they ever probably imagined they would become.
Yep, yeah, absolutely. You know, this is a party that believes men are women. So you can just imagine.
Well, it's a party that says they're trying to defend democracy and protect democracy. And
yeah,
Jamie Raskin,
people off the ballot.
Yeah, and even though the Supreme Court said you can't do that to the states, Jamie Raskin said, well, then we can do it at the federal level. So he's got a bill now to try to remove Donald Trump from the ballot, which, of course, would mean the people don't get a choice. Well, is that not the very definition of denying democracy? If you don't let the people choose, then they don't have democracy. So to protect democracy, we have to kill democracy. That's a Democrat. That's literally a Democrat talking point now.
Yep, absolutely. They do that with a straight face because, as I said, ad infinitum that the media permits them to do so. And, by the way, Raskin's bill wouldn't go in. I mean, first of all, it's not going to go anywhere because they don't have a majority in the House. But more importantly is it comes as close to a bill of attainder or export post facto law as you possibly can get. It cannot apply to this president or this candidate for office. It can't do that under, I think it's Article 1, Section 9. That renders, this kind of stuff, maybe it's Article 9, Section 3. It doesn't matter, Bob. In the Constitution, you can't do something like that, so it cannot apply to Donald Trump.
Right. There you go. That's well said. So, Peter, in just a couple minutes we have left here, rather than diving into Tom McClintock is now questioning. Nadler went up there and did whatever embarrassing thing he was doing while we were talking. I did not feel the need to bring him up. But McClintock, and I'm sure we're both going to be watching this closely throughout the rest of the day. But just a couple of other quick points then, Pete, while we're here. I haven't talked to you since Thursday night in the State of the Union. He was pumped up on, I don't know, B12 and Monster and Red Bull and Lord knows what other drugs were in the cocktail. And we saw him with the energy and the vigor trying to disprove he's a weak, frail 81-year-old man. Look at me yell. Look at me scream and all of those things. Well, yesterday, Peter, he was in New Hampshire. And he was in New Hampshire, putting people to sleep. Pretty much into a coma, and when the drugs wear off, things are very, very different. Listen to how it sounded without the drugs. I'm going to have to pause the hearing here so I can play you this clip. This is what it sounds like when the State of the Union drugs aren't included.
Tremendous amount of things you can cut. Maybe precise. Tremendous amount of things you can do, not cut. He said, "I will." But the bottom line is, he's still at it.
Peter, your reaction to the State of the Union and then what I just played.
Again, racist ipso loquitur. I think it speaks for itself, but I'll just say this.
You and your Latin.
That
I don't speak Latin. I got to guess by context what you're saying. Go ahead.
Yeah. First of all, as people have said, because it struck me when I watched it, I didn't watch the whole thing because I couldn't stomach the whole thing, but I just wanted to get a sense for what was happening. Imagine if, again, anybody else, but let's put Trump in there, had shouted the way he did. They would think that the man had lost his mind, and the media would be talking about it for months. He sounded deranged because we've seen what he's like in the past. Everybody who's commented, except for the partisan Democrats, but I repeat myself when it comes to the media, said he's on something. Okay, he's on. There's no doubt he's on something, and he probably rehearsed the State of the Union address 17,000 times. So it's not impressive that he was able to talk fast as opposed to his usual halting and stumbling. That's not a surprise. The content, however, was horrific. If you paused for it, if you are American of any stripe except for far-left radicals, you have to listen to some of what he had to say. First of all, he's making claims that didn't happen. That happens in a lot of State of the Union's address. And you know, we know it's going to be at least a little bit partisan in today's hyper-partisan environment. But the thing that I thought was despicable, outright despicable, is he later apologized for calling the killer of Lakin Riley, whose name he butchered, saying that he's not, he apologized for saying he was an illegal immigrant. He's apologizing to a murderer. He's apologizing to a murderer who's in this country by virtue of this individual's own policies. He didn't apologize to Lakin Riley's family at all, didn't call Lakin Riley's family at all, claims that to NBC that illegals built this country. How much more affront, how much more offense are we supposed to take from the President of the United States of America?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, I put a little slight 59-second long montage here of the difference between President Trump talking about the Lakin Riley situation and President Biden talking about the Lincoln Riley situation. Pete, let's wrap our conversation with this, and you can just listen, and you don't have to react if you don't want, but just listen to them back to back because it so clearly defines our choices in November.
Biden went on television and apologized for calling Lincoln's murderer an illegal.
You used the word illegal.
He didn't want to call him illegal.
An undocumented person.
He said undocumented.
And I shouldn't have used illegal. It's undocumented.
Not an illegal. And he wanted to apologize.
So you regret using that word?
Yes.
Well, they have a new name, too. You know what the new name is? Neighbor.
And I shouldn't have used illegal.
They want to call him neighbor.
An undocumented person.
They want to call him another name. Did you ever hear the other one? Newcomer.
I shouldn't have used illegal.
A newcomer to our country.
An undocumented person.
No, he was illegal. And I say he was an illegal alien.
I'm not going to treat any of these people with disrespect.
He was an illegal immigrant.
An undocumented person.
He was an illegal migrant.
So you regret using that word?
Yes.
And he shouldn't have been in our country, and he never would have been under the Trump policy.
I'm not going to treat any of these people with disrespect.
God forbid he treat a murderer of an innocent American girl with disrespect, Peter.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something that he hasn't apologized for. He hasn't apologized for calling Lakin Lincoln, hasn't apologized for the 100,000 people who died every year because of fentanyl pouring across the border, the hundreds who have gained entrance into this country, or for allowing hundreds of terrorists to gain interest to this country, thousands of Chinese nationals pouring across the border. This is a moral cretin who doesn't have the brains enabling him to achieve or remain in office without the lies and distortions and omissions of an utterly corrupt and biased mainstream media.
That's a good way to wrap it up.
The Trump-endorsed conservative for Senate. Club for Growth Action is responsible for the content of this ad. Paid for by Club for Growth Action and not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee. ClubForGrowthAction.org.
This hour of Always Right Radio is brought to you by The Floor King and KeepingMedicareSimple.com.
You and I know and do not believe that life is so dear and peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. If nothing in life is worth dying for, when did this begin? Just in the face of this enemy? Or should Moses have told the children of Israel to live in slavery under the Pharaohs? Should Christ have refused the cross? Should the patriots at Concord Bridge have thrown down their guns and refused to fire the shot heard round the world? The martyrs of history were not fools. And our honored dead, who gave their lives to stop the advance of the Nazis, didn't die in vain. Where then is the road to peace? Well, it's a simple answer after all. You and I have the courage to say to our enemies, there is a price we will not pay. There is a point beyond which they must not advance.
This is Always Right Radio with Bob France on AM 1420, The Answer.
All right. It is 11:09. Thanks for being with us this morning on AM 1420, The Answer. Thanks again to Peter Kirsanoff for kind of navigating through a little bit of a rough conversation, only because we were trying to listen to the extraordinarily important testimony and questions and answers of Robert Hur, special counsel Robert Hur, who's testifying before Jim Jordan's House Judiciary Committee right now about Joe Biden and about Joe Biden's willful keeping and trafficking classified documents, including some top secret documents that he had no right to have, not as a vice president, not as a senator. He kept them after he left office. He did not have the right to declassify them. And that's what this hearing is all about. Why didn't Robert Hur, when making that determination, also then say he is therefore charged with felonies, federal crimes? There will be a trial. The answer, as you know by now, is Robert Hur said, well, he's a likable, well-intentioned, old, frail man with a bad memory, and no jury is going to convict him because of that. It's literally what he wrote. It's what he testified to in his opening remarks. He's been answering questions now from Republicans and Democrats in typical committee alternating fashion. Last set of questions came from a Democrat, and Chairman Jordan decided to pull rank, if you will, and ask questions of his own immediately following that. This is where I want to pick it up right now.
The chair is recognized. Mr. Hur, why did he do it? Why did Joe Biden, in your words, willfully retain and disclose classified materials? I mean, he knew the law. Been in office like 50 years. 5 decades in the United States Senate, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, 8 years... as vice president, he got briefed every day as vice president. He's been in the situation room. In fact, you know he knew the rules because you said so on page 226. President Biden was deeply familiar with the measures taken to safeguard classified documents. And Joe Biden told us he knew the rules. Mr. Armstrong said this earlier. Joe Biden was deeply familiar with it. You're exactly right, because he told us when Jack Smith goes after President Trump, Joe Biden says, how could this happen? What data was in those documents that could compromise sources and methods? It's irresponsible. So Joe Biden knew the rules. You know he knew the rules. And Joe Biden told us he knew the rules. So, Mr. Hur, why did he break them?
Congressman, the conclusion as to exactly why the president did what he did is not one that we explicitly address in the report. The report explains my decision to the attorney general that no criminal charges were warranted in this manner.
I think you did tell us. I think you told us, Mr. Hur. Page 231, you said this. President Biden had strong motivations. That's a key word. We're getting to motive now. President Biden had strong motivations to ignore the proper procedures for safeguarding the classified information in his notebooks. Why did he have strong motivations? Because, next word, because he decided months before leaving office to write a book. To write a book. That was his motive. He knew the rules. He broke them because he was writing a book. And you further say, and he began meeting with the ghostwriter while he was still vice president. There's the motive. Mr. Hur, how much did President Biden get paid for his book?
I'm going to pause that there because I want to underscore the home run that that line was. Robert Hur said, I didn't really explore motive. I just explored whether or not he did it. He did. And whether or not he should face charges for it. No, I don't think he should. So I don't know what the motive was. And Jim Jordan was ready with chapter and verse and line. He was motivated because he was going to write a book, which is why he gave these classified documents to a non-security clearance-having individual known as his biographer, his autobiographer, his ghostwriter. Because as I said to Peter, there's no way Joe Biden could ever write anything. I don't think he could write a note on a cocktail napkin without looking at somebody else's napkin and copying what they wrote. His entire career has been one plagiarized speech after another, going back to his time in law school. But nonetheless, he wants to write a book and get credit for it, but he can't write, so he's got to have a ghostwriter do it. And he gave him classified documents. That was the motivation. And he knew it was illegal. He knew the rules, as Jordan just said. He knew what the rule of law was, and he broke it. Why did he break it? To write the book. Why did he want to write the book? Because he was going to make money. Let's pick it up there.
Off the top of my head, I'm not sure if that information appears in the report.
Sure does. There's a dollar amount in there. You remember?
I don't. It may be $8 million.
So I'm sorry, but Robert Hur just played, you know, revealed some of his hand. How much did he make for the book, Mr. Hur? I don't think that's in the report. Wait a minute. You wrote the report. How do you say you don't think it's in the report? You wrote the report. You know what's in it. How come Jim Jordan knew immediately, said where it was, and then suddenly you remembered, I think it's $8 million? I think he just revealed his cards. He's not going to be honest and forthcoming with all truthful information in this hearing. He just tried to steer Jim Jordan away from motivation. And now that I've heard the number, and now that you've heard the number, doesn't the number speak for itself? He had 8 million reasons to break federal law. He had 8 million reasons to expose classified and top secret information to strangers without security clearance, like his ghostwriter. He had 8 million reasons to store stuff at the Penn Biden Center, to store stuff in his garage, next to his vet, to put classified information in play to potentially bad actors, like his ghostwriter, because we don't know anything about him or his motivations, and like his son, whose motivation would be, I like crack, and I get more crack when I have more money. Money is good. Money allows me to buy drugs. Then I use drugs, and then I run out of drugs, and I need more money. Why do you think he took a job on all of these boards and all of these companies and all of these foreign countries that are adversarial to the United States? Because they want information, and they want access to the Obama administration, the White House. So he figures out, look at this. If I connect these people with my dad, the vice president, and dad hooks them up by connecting him with Obama, I get money. And when I get more money, I can buy more drugs. And when I get more drugs, I get more happy. When I get more happy, I get more hookers. And when I get drugs and hookers, I'm really happy. Well, what's to say that the same drug-addled, hooker-happy son of the president of the United States isn't going to see the box next to the vet that dad lets him drive, perhaps while high on crack? What's to prevent him from seeing the box? What's this? Hey, what are those markings on here? Holy cow. I thought that box was filled with dad's old Playboys. It's not. That old box is filled with classified documents. I wonder what these would go for. I wonder how much money I could get for these and how much crack that money could buy me and how many hookers that would bring me and how much more happy that would make me. Now, I don't know if any of those things that I just described happened, but I know they could have, which is why the law is what the law is. The law says he can't have those things because they can't be allowed to fall into the wrong hands. They can't be allowed to be accessed by people that might have ulterior motives or that might have nefarious goals or that just might really, really like crack and hookers. That's why the law exists. He had 8 million reasons to leave, to take those things with him to make his book. And when he left them laying around haphazardly, he should be facing federal charges. I mean, let's look at the reality here. Let's do a little comparative, and then I'll go back to listening to more of that and playing some of it for you. Let's do a tale of the tape. Donald Trump declassifies documents that he's allowed to declassify as president of the United States, takes them with him to Mar-a-Lago, a residence that, by the way, is under Secret Service protection because he's the president and maintains Secret Service protection when he's an ex-president. takes them to Mar-a-Lago, which is probably about as secure of a place as something could be, quite frankly, with Secret Service being on site. So Donald Trump takes documents that he can declassify, therefore not breaking the law, and is charged with 40 federal charges for keeping those documents that he could declassify. Joe Biden takes boxes and boxes and boxes of documents that he is not able to declassify because he was not the president of the United States, takes them and passes some of them off to a writer who had zero security clearance to see them, makes them available to a crack and hooker happy son, and faces zero charges. Democrats' response to that is bullseye. That's how it's done. That's how it's supposed to be done. Absolutely home run, grand slam. Let's go home. Trump in prison, Biden free, and Biden counting $8 million for the book. All right, let's go back.
Dollars. Joe Biden had 8 million reasons to break the rules.
He stole my line. I didn't hear this yet. He stole my line.
Took classified information and shared it with the guy who was writing the book. That's why he did. He knew the rules, but he broke them for $8 million in a book advance. But you know what? It wasn't just the money. Joe Biden, here's this page 231, very next page. Joe Biden, in your report, Joe Biden viewed his notebooks as an irreplaceable, contemporaneous record of the most important moments of his vice presidency. He'd written this all down for the book, for the $8 million. And the next thing you say in your report is, quote, such a record would buttress his legacy as a world leader. You know what this is? It wasn't just the money. It wasn't just $8 million. It was also his ego. Pride and money is why he knowingly violated the rules. The oldest motives in the book, pride and money. You agree with that, Mr. Herr? You wrote it in your report.
That language, and it does appear in the report, and we did identify evidence supporting those assessments.
You also had another interesting statement in your report. You said Joe Biden, I want to make sure I get this right, viewed himself as a man of presidential timber. Remember that statement, Mr. Herr?
I believe that does appear in the report, at least in the executive summary.
I think this is interesting, because here's the scary part. Page 200. I said this earlier in my opening statement. Page 200. Joe Biden, this is a quote, Joe Biden risked serious damage to America's national security when he shared information with his ghostwriter. Shared it with his ghostwriter, the guy who was helping Joe Biden get $8 million. And oh, by the way, Mr. Herr, what did that ghostwriter do with the information Joe Biden shared with him on his laptop? What did he do after you were named special counsel?
Chairman, if you're referring to the audio recordings that Mr. Zwanitzer created of his conversations with
exactly
Biden,
what I'm referring to.
He slid, if I remember correctly, he slid those files into his recycle bin on his computer.
Tried to destroy the evidence, didn't he?
Correct.
All right. I don't know about you. I'm hearing all kinds of reasons to charge him with federal crimes. He did it for money. He did it for prestige and legacy. And when he was getting busted, he tried to cover it up and slid them into the recycle bin, hoping to then delete that. And then what? What after that? You know when I do. Two words. Seth, I bet you know. What two words would he use to make sure they couldn't be retrieved from the recycle bin or anywhere else on that computer? They go back to Hillary Clinton. Bleach bit. Remember that? When Hillary was caught stealing a bunch of classified documents that she didn't have the right to declassify because she was only Secretary of State. Excuse me. She wasn't even Vice President. She was Secretary of State. And she wasn't allowed. She took all of those, whether or not in paper form, but in digital form, on her server, her unsecured server in her broom closet in Chappaqua, New York. And they were accessed, by the way, by foreign bad actors. And James Comey of the FBI found out that not only did she take them all, when she realized the jig was up, she had her cell phone devices smashed with sledgehammers to ruin the hard drives on those so nothing could be recovered. Then she used something called Bleach Bit to erase all evidence of the classified documents that she had on her server to make sure that no forensic computer experts would be able to access those things. So she tried to, not only first she committed the crime, then she committed the cover-up, and James Comey knew it all. And here's the coincidence. Wink, wink. James Comey said she committed all of these crimes. He spent 20 minutes in a national press conference telling everybody what he found. 20 minutes detailing her crimes and cover-up. Then said, by the way, I don't recommend prosecuting her. And now here's Robert Hur. Spends hundreds of pages investigating Joe Biden for almost the same thing, but instead of digital on a server, it's physical paper in boxes. And same thing. Here's all of his crimes. Bing, bang, boom, boom, boom. Jim Jordan is recounting them right now. But no, I don't think we should prosecute. Democrats steal classified documentation, and it gets accessed by non-security clearance actors. In Hillary's case, foreign hackers, and in Biden's case, his own personal ghostwriter. So they break the laws, have classified information fall into the wrong hands, no charges. Donald Trump has the authority as president to declassify the documents he took, keeps them in Mar-a-Lago, they don't fall into the wrong hands, facing 40 federal charges. Tell me again, Democrats, how no one is above the law. Tell me again, Democrats, how we have a single-tiered system of justice and not two tiers, one for Republicans and one for Democrats. Tell me more.
Very guy who was helping Joe Biden get the $8 million, $8 million Joe Biden used, the motive for Joe Biden to disclose classified information, to retain classified information, which he definitely knew was against the law. When you get named special counsel, what's that guy do? He destroys the evidence. That's the key takeaway in my mind. That's the key takeaway.
Jim Jordan just, again, hitting it out of the park in today's testimony with special counsel Robert Hur testifying before the House Judiciary Committee. We'll come back with
the Liberty. Paid for by Scott Lynch for Judge.
Keeping you informed among the uninformed. Always Right Radio with Bob France on The Answer.
11:34. If you just turned the radio on, you missed, dare I say, a hell of a show. I mean, a really, really a lot of very good stuff we've done today. Make sure you go back and catch up at the end of the show at whkradio.com. Go to the podcast page, Conversations. And I want to continue now for the last several minutes that we have with the Robert Hur hearing as he testifies before the House Judiciary Committee about the report that he filed saying Joe Biden broke a whole bunch of laws, but I do not recommend charging him because he's old and has a bad memory. Matt Gaetz is always worth the listen.
5 minutes.
February 8th, the White House. Question, Mr. President, why did you share classified information with your ghostwriter? The President, I did not share classified information. I did not share it. I guarantee I did not. That's not true, is it, Mr. Hur?
That is inconsistent with the findings based on the evidence in my report.
Yes, yeah, so it's a lie. It's just what regular people would say, right? Yeah, all right. So the next one. And all the stuff that was in my home was in filing cabinets that were either locked or able to be locked. That wasn't true either, was it?
That was inconsistent with the findings of our investigation.
Another lie, people might say, right? Because what you put in your report was among the places Mr. Biden's lawyers found classified documents in the garage was a damaged open box. So here's what I'm understanding, right? As Mr. Armstrong laid out, you find in your report that the elements of a federal criminal violation are met. But then you apply this senile cooperator theory that because Joe Biden cooperated and the elevator doesn't go to the top floor, you don't think you get a conviction. And I actually think you get to the right answer in that. I don't think Biden should have been charged. Don't think Trump should have been charged. But under the senile cooperator theory, isn't it frustrating that Biden continues to go out and lie about the basic facts of the report that lay out a federal criminal violation?
Congressman, I need to disagree with at least one thing that you said, which is that I found that all of the elements were met. One of the elements of the relevant mishandling statute is the intent element, and what my report reflects is my judgment that based on the evidence, I would not be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury that that intent element had been
met. Right, but the reason you have that doubt is the senile cooperator theory. The fact that Joe Biden is so inept in responding that you can't prove the intent, which, again, I don't quibble with that conclusion, but it's frustrating to be like, oh, well, this guy's not getting treated the same way as Trump because the elevator's not going to the top floor, so we can't prove intent, while at the same time Biden goes out there at the White House and says, well, you know, He just blatantly lies. And what I'm trying to figure out is whether or not Biden's lying because he's still so senile, he hasn't read your report, or whether it's a little craftier and a little more devious and perhaps a little more intentional than we might otherwise think. So I also want to go to this Biden Penn Center. Like, did it give concern to you that the Biden Penn Center, where all this classified stuff was being mishandled, was being floated by foreign governments?
Congressman, we were concerned with getting to the bottom of all of the classified documents that were recovered during the course of our...
Yeah, but what bothers me is that the money that was paying for the place where the documents were being inappropriately held, it was the Chinese and it was other foreign countries. Did that play into your analysis? Did you look into the $1 billion in foreign funding sources at the Biden Center at UPenn, for example?
Congressman, we conducted a thorough, impartial, and fair investigation, and we were very, very concerned with getting to the bottom of all the relevant questions relating to the recovered documents.
Sir, did you look into the fact that the Chinese were floating the place where this guy was keeping the documents unsecure? Yes or no?
Congressman, to the extent that we identified evidence that was relevant and significant to our investigation, we put it in our report.
Okay. Well, it seemed relevant to me, maybe not to you. Another thing that seemed relevant to me is this ghostwriter, right? So the ghostwriter purposefully deletes this evidence that seems to be like show culpability of Biden's crimes, and you don't charge him. Why did you not charge the ghostwriter with obstructing justice and deleting evidence?
Well, for a number of reasons that are laid out in the report, but in brief, Congressman, yes, when we interviewed the ghostwriter, he did tell us, and I'm trying to get the exact language, that one of the things on his mind, one of the things he was aware of, was that I had been appointed special counsel and was conducting an investigation.
Right, so he didn't, just so everybody knows, the ghostwriter didn't delete the recordings just as a matter of happenstance. Ghostwriter has recordings of Biden making admissions of crimes. He then learns that you've been appointed. He then deletes the information that is the evidence, and you don't charge him.
That is reflected in the report, and one of the reasons...
Like, what does somebody have to do to get charged with obstruction of justice by you? If deleting the evidence of crimes doesn't count, what would meet the standard?
So, Congressman, as we state in the relevant chapter of the report, one of the things that Mr. Zwanitzer did not delete was transcripts of the recordings that he had created that included inculpatory evidence relating to Mr. Biden.
Oh, so if you destroy some evidence but not other evidence, that somehow absolves you of the evidence you destroy? Here's what I see. Zwaniger should have been charged, wasn't. Biden and Trump should have been treated equally. They weren't. And that is the double standard that I think a lot of Americans are concerned about. I see my time's expired. I yield back.
Well, there it is. Matt Gaetz doing exactly what needed to be done there, and that is exposing the agenda here. Robert Herr, like I said, you knew he was going to take it from both sides. I said this with Peter Kirsten when he was on earlier. Robert Herr was going to take it from the Republicans because he did not charge, and he's going to take it from the Democrats because he dared to say the reason he didn't charge is Joe Biden is incompetent. Joe Biden is old. Joe Biden is too senile and too memory-addled to be able to have formed the intent to do these things. Yet, intent was delineated when he declared, Robert Herr, that Joe Biden's actions were, quote-unquote, willful. And Jim Jordan just laid all of that bare when he said, what was his motivation for this willful conduct? I don't know. We didn't get into that. Oh, but you did get into that. What do you mean? Well, you got into it when you put on page whatever it was that he wanted to write a book. That's why he kept all of this stuff. And why was he doing that? I don't know. How much was he going to get paid? I don't know. It's in your report. I don't think it is. Sure it is. It's how much is it? It's $8 million. Oh, it was in your report. How about that? Robert Herr is essentially, running cover for Joe Biden. At the end of the day, while he's going to, I agree with Pete. At the end of the day, I wouldn't want to be in his seat today because he's going to take it from both sides. But he has decided which side he's on. He's made this very, very clear which side that he is on. Because at the end of the day, his report, it doesn't exonerate, but it doesn't charge Biden. So he has to. When this is all over with. He has to justify his decision not to bring the charges. So he's going to obfuscate. He's going to lie. He's going to, try to manipulate the data and the information that he wrote. He's going to try to pretend some of it isn't there or that he doesn't know the context because it, after it's all said and done, I'm sick and tired of saying it at the end of the day. But when it's all said and done, he's going to have to explain why he did not choose to charge Joe Biden and make him face a jury the way Donald Trump is going to have to face a jury. So he's going to do everything he can to get in the way of what the Republicans are trying to do there. Here's Daryl Issa.
Need me to ask you for conclusions. One question is, were there notes of the President of the United States that dated back to when he was a senator that contained classified information?
Among the documents that were recovered during our investigation were marked classified documents that dated back to when Mr. Okay. Biden was a senator.
When he was in his 30s, 40s, 50s.
I believe that's correct.
Were there documents from the time that he was vice president?
Yes.
Okay. So there's been a lot to do about, senility, non-senility, poor memory, and so on. But let's just go through something that you deal with as a prosecutor every day. You first start off with a set of initial evidence that indicates there may have been a crime. Is that right? By the time it gets...
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.